But getting back to what you started on by saying, you actually welcomed your mother coming up to the nursery then, did you? I mean, it was something you looked forward to.
Oh, yes.
With company as a,
yes.
As a child.
Well, it's a long time to look back to, but it seemed to me to be pleasurable. And as I remember it, you see, even if she wasn't drawing while we were drawing, she was reading aloud to us. And I've always been a glutton for being read aloud to.
What about sort of physical things like swimming or playing on the beach when you went to West Bay or whatever?
Oh, yes, she was always there. Though looking back at the beach, I think my father was in many ways there more. Well, she was always very much there, and all the photos of us, she's right in among us, spurring us on to do something, or playing games with us, or anyway, supplying us with towels, and getting us in and out. Much more in a way than Nanny. I don't know whether Nanny was there less, but I remember my mother much more on the beach than Nanny. And she adored West Bay. It had, of course, been where she'd been as a child, and the boats had been her boats, and she taught us sculling, or she must have taught most of us sculling. And she could swim. She enjoyed swimming, and it was so beastly cold. Colder for her than it was for us.
She kept herself fit, really, in a way. She, I suppose she was the generation where smoking wasn't considered bad for you, and so there's no contradiction there, really, so in the fact that she smoked so much.
Really, she did smoke a lot. And as a child, she used to make her own cigarettes because the bought cigarettes weren't thick enough. And I very uppishly gave her one of those machines for rolling cigarettes, which she accepted very graciously, but it wasn't any good because it made thinner cigarettes. And she had that lovely brass jar which she kept her tobacco in.
But
there is, of course, a physical satisfaction in rolling your own cigarettes.
Yes.
It's rather like the movements my father used to make stuffing his pipe. It is
a relaxing thing.
Mm.
When you say she was restless so much, this is always doing something, is it?
Always doing something, not sitting. And I used to think, to stop herself thinking about being alone and my father not being there. And yet they were a very distant pair. And we used to wonder how we had ever got conceived, looking at the two widely dispersed iron beds with their hair mattresses at opposite ends of the room. And I think they took no pleasure in their consummation. They just took pleasure in each other's company.
That was presumably an intellectual partnership in a way.
Yes.
I mean, did they, of course it's difficult for you to remember, I imagine, but did they argue and talk?
Oh, always. Mm. All the time. Everybody did. All the time. And yet it wasn't enormously learned. Well, it was frustrating for us because my father would stand at one end, carving the joint, and my mother would stand at the other with the vegetable dishes. And she would stand over the vegetable dish, doing this with the spoon instead of serving, answering my father, or asking, or arguing, or discussing. And we would say, come on.
Well, obviously, Aaron, the food wasn't the important thing.
No, the food wasn't the important thing. Except, of course, we used to have Lord Simon's daughter. They were near neighbours, just up the road from us. And she used to come for Wednesday lunch with us. For some reason, I suppose Lady Simon was out or something. swimming. And there came a time when she no longer needed to come. And she was very upset. And they were a little hurt. And they said, well, what's so much better about the Stockses and coming home to us? And, oh, it's the conversation. And they were even more hurt. They said, but what do they talk about? I mean, we talk, what do they talk about? Oh, food, food, all the time. So it wasn't stimulating conversation. It was just argument about anything.
Yes.
Discussion.
So when you asked questions of your parents and so on, I mean, it was a sort of stimulating.
No, not for me.
Wasn't it?
It may have been for my sister, but for me, I always asked the wrong questions, and they were always ridiculous, and I was always slapped down. So I was very wary about asking questions. I didn't find it easy.
What was wrong with your questions then?
Well, they were stupid. And also, of course, I always stood and said, but it's not true, you know, I mean, what you're telling me, you may think Aristotle is Aristotle, but it's not. He wrote plays. He did other things. And I dug my toes in. I was very obstinate. Mm. So that didn't go down well. But I think it's possible that my father was a very straight classicist and exact. And it used to irritate my mother, who never could spell or not enormously well, when she would say, how do you spell so-and-so? And he'd say, well, how would you spell it? And that's such a waste of time, you see. So then she would say, well, you could spell it like this, you could spell it like that, you could spell it like that. And he'd say, well, no, but it comes from the Latin, don't you see? The first half comes from so-and-so, and it has the definitive so-and-so. So that didn't get down well either.
It's a little bit patronising, isn't it, in a way, to sort of talk to your wife like that, I suppose.
Well, I
don't teaching her,
he really meant it like that. He just thought that next time she wouldn't ask him how to spell it, or whatever it was.
You get on to more important things. What sort of man was he, actually? You have
absolutely
quite
enchanting.
A vivid memory of him.
Absolutely enchanting. And, of course, he'd mend anything, and he'd solve anything. I did make the mistake of trying to teach him logarithms when I learnt logarithms, because I thought it was such a pity he didn't do them at all. But in fact, he could multiply any three figures by any other three figures without logarithms, and that was about as far as I'd got. And he spent all his spare time, I suppose about 20 years, on Little and Scott, bringing up to date just two letters. And he died before he really finished. Pie and Row, I think he had, just on the classical illusions.
It's very difficult, I suppose, for a child to see what attracts what attracted each other in the parents, and can you see what they liked about each other?
I don't think I know at all. I would think, I don't know.
It's presumably it's part of
his gentleness, of course.
Yes.
He's very, well, he was a strong pacifist, but he was the only one of his brothers, really, who went to war. And his, most of the things are things that in a way irritated her. His intense centering on trying to love the Germans. And he went on trying to love the Germans. And he had every right to dislike them. He got badly wounded by them and was constantly slapped down by them. But he was very interested in German political philosophy. And he had a number of philosophic friends that he went over to the Black Forest to visit, as the Americans say, a visit with. And he'd collected a lot of manuscripts in conjunction with his friend in the Black Forest. on his Aristotelianism that had built up a sort of unique library. But I don't know what it was they had together.
You said she actually really did take seriously the business of being a vice chancellor's wife.
Oh, yes.
Well, how did you notice that then?
Well, because in Manchester we didn't. We entertained, but not rarely. People came to supper, and my father was the public orator, and so when degree givings came, we always had someone delicious to stay with us. And of course, we had lovely German refugees. And we had a German refugee who lived with us for quite a long time, and we had a lot of German refugees. But when we went to Liverpool, and after all, he was only there 9 months. She was resolutely, as vice-chancellor's wife, having finished all the work in Manchester, you see, she hadn't started picking up work in Liverpool, and presumably didn't intend to, until she'd got, as it were, settled there, to see what time she had that was to spare.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And so she was literally working through the academic staff, on an alphabetical basis, entertaining evening parties. Mm.
So there's no question of her career fighting with his at all. I mean,
I would say not at all.
She, in a sense, subordinates her career.
I think that he consulted her very fully before he put in for Liverpool. And I know that he thought a lot before he even mentioned Liverpool. Mm. And I think probably he recognised that she was really London orientated. And it wasn't until I was very, very adult, oh, long time, that I really came to the conclusion that I can't think how she was happy anywhere else, because she was so very London, so very much tied to her family.
And to the sort of milieu, really, the streets and the...
Yes, I think the streets more than anything else, because, I mean, the bulk of her family planning, which was a thing she was very keen on, was certainly in the north.
She also rather liked power, didn't she? She liked being near power.
I think she liked being near power. I don't think she ever would have admitted it, but I think she did like being near power. And she did really prefer the company of men. She really did hate this hiving off of the women being one end of the room and the men the other.
Yes, that's a characteristic of...
And I think this first arose... my parents started... broadcasting, I suppose about 1926, and the first thing that they did in Manchester was a thing called Mary and John Discussing, or something like that, and they had an argument, they were to have an argument on the radio, and she had to lose, and she didn't see any reason why she shouldn't lose. And I remember that I think she really minded, because my father would have been delighted. I mean, didn't mind how the argument went. They just took pleasure in arguing. But the idea that she had to, at the end, say, "Yes, my dear, I see you're right," sort of thing.
She was extremely good broadcaster, because I knew her long before I ever got interested in the women's movement, and I suppose part of her skill was, as a broadcaster looking back on it, was simply being able to say what everybody thinks in a rather crisper way than most of us would be capable of saying it. And there's a sort of commonsensicalness about her, well expressed, which...
Yes, the quickness of being able to think of the repartee, well, you can usually think of it next week. Mm-hmm. And she could think of it next minute.
What did you feel as a family, or you personally, I mean, when you heard her on the radio, did you feel, yes, this is Mother? this is just what she's like, or did she seem somehow different to you, you know, in her public image, so to speak?
Well, I remember her broadcasting most, sort of the last 20 years, when I constantly disagreed with what she said. It seemed to me old-fashioned in many cases. And of course, latterly, I could disagree with almost everything she said. It seemed to me very reactionary. But I enjoyed the funny bits.
Mm. One thing that did strike me, I'll be quite frank with you now about this, I was rather surprised in a way when I met your mother that she was really very, well, I would almost say vain, actually.
Yes.
She was very concerned for her own reputation,
yes,
or at least for her public image and things.
I think I was surprised about that.
I mean, I didn't somehow expect that would be the case.
No, and I think she would have been very surprised if she had realized it, because it's the last thing she would have wanted. But I think you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And this was aligned to what you said about her liking to be near power. Mm-hmm. And of course, this happened to her, of course, in the House of Lords, and it was one of the reasons she adored it, because any subject you were trying to think of, whether it was Suez or what happened here now, or the people who were actually involved in it were there, the real sources. There's no reading books about what somebody said in somebody's book, Marx on Marx. Mm. It was the real source. It was really a wonderful reward she had.
And she loved going there for sort of social reasons, apart from speaking. And
yes, she said this was the best old people's home, old people's club in the country. But she, I must say, she did very much appreciate. I don't know whether you ever saw the letters patent or whatever they're called of her peerage, and it did say to her and to the wife of our well-beloved and noble son. Don Leofric Stocks, DSO, and she did it. She very much appreciated that.
Did she? Mm-hmm. Yes. Did she talk a lot about your father after he died? I mean, it was entirely.
Well, I suppose I didn't see her for the next 2 years or so after my father died, and then she was very much fraught, trying to earn enough money to keep the three of us going. Whether she talked to my sister at all about my father, but as far as I can remember, she never mentioned him at all.
That really leads me to another thing, really. What about emotion, really, with her?
She didn't hold an emotion. Mm. We are a family that don't kiss people. She never kissed us, and we never kissed each other. And yet, in later life, kissing goes on much more. She appreciated very much certain lords with whom she was on kissing terms. Not necessarily lords, but people like Vic Feather and Selwyn Lloyd that she was on kissing terms with. She liked this very much. But there wasn't an emotion in it.
No.
She is not as afraid of emotion as my sister, but very afraid of emotion, I think.
Mm. It's all part of the sort of austerity, really, isn't it, I suppose? I mean, you just don't indulge yourself in any situation. You keep control over yourself because you want to do things, I suppose, and you want to achieve things and write things or whatever it is.
Yes, I don't think emotion, no.
So that wasn't a problem for you as children, I suppose, because this shutting off of emotion is a characteristic of the middle classes generally at that type, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's probably so.
And you don't remember feeling your mother was different from other mothers in that respect. I mean, it was quite a common middle class way of behaving, really, wasn't it, I suppose?
Yes, I mean, certainly not as regards emotion. We did think we were different sometimes, but certainly not in that way. No. And we didn't really have servants in the way that other people had servants. I mean, when we came to London at Christmas, as we always used to do, every Christmas we used to go to Christmas tea, sometime during Christmas, with the George Rendles, this man who was an ambassador. And we hated it. There used to be a Christmas tree, and all his servants came in starched and curtsied and were given a little present in front of the Christmas tree. And we were all little Miss So-and-so and little Miss So-and-so, and there were none of this Miss and Master in ours. It was terrible.
Too formal, really.
It was all so formal and stiff and... Oh, yes, it was horrible.
Were your parents, in a way, or your mother, were they, in a way, very relaxed in their attitude to you? I mean, did you call them by their Christian names?
No, but then I don't think anybody did call them by them. I don't think that was... No, certainly not.
I imagine they were quite, sort of, quote, progressive for their day, were they, in bringing up children?
No, I shouldn't think so. No, I don't think so. I think, in fact, they were really rather poor. It hadn't occurred to them that they could save money by not having servants, and I don't think they could have done, really, because they were terribly busy, apart from their earning things. They were all busy on WEA work, you see. My father, apart from his earning, this dictionary didn't pay him anything. And he always had a couple of WA classes, perhaps two a week going on. And there were other things. And the university settlement took up a lot of that time, and that was non-paying. So they were spending so much of that time on non-earning pursuits. He did a lot of examining, which presumably paid. I think he probably did examining outside his ordinary university professorial stuff. And they ran a car because they really needed a car to get out in the foggy nights. Mm. And for carrying us around, of course. But I don't think that they really had very much money. Mm. It always appalled me that my father, being a classical scholar, never got to Greece.
Didn't he?
And my mother went abroad occasionally. She went abroad, but then before she married, she used to go abroad. She came from a family that went winter sporting, which is a thing that has never cropped up in my family. And she went abroad after, but always when it was paid for, either by her mother or Eleanor Rathbone. Something like that.
Eleanor would pay for her to go abroad, or she'd come.
No, I should think probably that she paid on those occasions, but that would have egged her on to go off for a fortnight somewhere. I think she went twice with them. I mean, some of the time it was in England or Scotland. But you see, they never had wine in the house. In the summer we had this awful, well, I suppose it wasn't awful, I think it was after my father came back from the West Indies when he was ill, they had cold tea with lemon juice and stuff in it. Mm. And when my sister had 21st birthday party, my father said, oh, I will do the wine. And he produced one bottle of Chateau Neuf du Pape. Fortunately, my mother did notice this, and the only bit of housekeeping I think she ever noticed, and went out and did something about it. But we didn't, and that was, of course, course, much later, it was the time of the German refugees, and they did rather encourage things like drinking.
You know, these refugees must have, in fact, been rather a burden in that situation, or did they contribute to the house?
I would think they... Well, we only had one living with us, a very nice professor living with us, who later got a house down the road and brought his family over. But they were always passing through, and which meant we had very nice evening parties. But I don't remember there being sort of food or drink particularly. Mm. I suppose it was tea and stuff.
Well, I mean, one has to be careful, doesn't one, to avoid judging them by the standard of living now. I mean, I think we all live much better, don't we, now, in that sense, than anyone did then. But still, that's interesting. But I always feel with your mother when I read some of her reviews and so on that she really is a real democrat in her bones. I mean, she lives democracy. She really believes in democracy and can expound it in the most lucid way. Did you sort of feel that in any sense? I suppose it's something one doesn't notice as a child.
I don't think it's something that I would have noticed. Mm. I don't think I would have noticed.
And she wrote some really excellent expositions in the Women's Leader of, you know, how the voting system works and, you know, how we should all do our duty in local government and things like that.
She never, I don't think either of them would have consulted us at all on any decision. Mm. But then I don't think parents did.
No, there's no contradiction in that, really.
And I mean, I think now children would know that their parents were relatively poor and were wondering where to get the next penny from. But I don't think we should have known. Mm.
Mm. But argument was encouraged, was it? I mean, you could disagree with your parents
on questions
quite easily, and you had... meal times were a time for discussion.
Yes. Oh yes, and of course we had fascinating guests. Mm. Always people passing through.
Who you'd be allowed to see?
Oh yes, all the time. Mm. Yes. Oh, no trouble about that. I didn't have trouble with that about that until we got to Liverpool, when suddenly I was pushed away, and we had a housekeeper and. That I didn't like. I was about 17 and not allowed to come out, as it were. Well, before at Manchester, I'd been on the verge of leaving school.
Mm. Well, if you're growing up then, what about education? What sort of attitudes to education did your parents have? Education in the broadest sense, I mean, bringing you up, sort of.
I don't really know. They just merely insisted that one went to school every day and did your homework, and that you would automatically go to university, and there was no way not to go to university, and you would have a year abroad in between. And I terribly didn't want to go to university. I thought I'd learnt that it was bad enough having to go to school every day, and the thought of having to go on for another 3 years filled me with dread. I didn't at all want to go abroad either. However, the war saved me. I was going to King's College, it was all settled. But in the end, I didn't have to go.
Was your mother interested in the Land Army work that you
Not
did?
At all, no.
Wasn't she really? That's surprising.
No, I only went into the Land Army because I thought it would be nice and safe. And I was always keen on engines. And I thought, well, if I trained to be a tractor driver, they get up an hour later, and I can spend my time tinkering with engines. And so I did that, and I went to Reading University and came top in ploughing, and it's the only exam I've ever been top in.
But you feel that your mother, anyway, by that time, rather wanted you to be academic, did she, in a way? I mean, she wished you to.
I don't think she ever said, but it never occurred to me there was any way out from this academic world. And indeed, I didn't know that I could leave school, that I was past the school leaving age. It never entered my head there was any way out of this.
Mm. You just assumed you were going forward in the groove.
And yet, I remember having to stay home one day from school with a sprained ankle and being told I couldn't go to school. And there was a ring at the bell and I thought, oh dear, it's an attendance officer. Now, why it should have crossed my mind that there should be an attendance officer, some sort of guilt complex that everyone had to go to school every day all the time.
But you'd have to do your homework, would you? I mean, you'd be really quite disciplined about that, all of you.
Not disciplined. I was like always. Of course, the things I remember most about Manchester are without my brother and sister, because my brother was always at boarding school, and my sister was 5 years older, and so almost always adult. So, in effect, I was an only child. Mm. And I did my homework in my father's study, and usually with Geraldo on the wireless at the same time. And nobody really interfered with that. I mean, they'd say, oh, surely you can't do it to that, and I'd say, that's the only way I can do it. And that was the end of that.
Mm-hmm. It surprised me what you say about the Landnám, because the Landnám is a rather an important way in which women spread out in English society. That is, they enter agricultural life and profession and so on. It's part of the women's movement, really. I'm surprised your mother wasn't interested in that, in a way.
Well, I don't think it was very much of a movement. And you see, you were very much individuals. You were parceled out, single people, to different farms. Mm-hmm. You didn't see other land army people once you got through your training. At any rate, she was, I suppose, busy. At Westfield, she was in Oxford by that time.
Yes, she would be, yes.
And I had a series of rather unsatisfactory postings and started to get myself out, or get her to get me out. And I think she very swiftly thought that if I came out, I would be put on a bomb site somewhere in the army, and encouraged me to go down to the Cornigate community, which was a reserved occupation, as it were. Which, of course, was exactly right, because I got my maladjusted children and it was in exactly the right place.
So you feel she knew, did she know you quite well, I mean, as a person?
No, I don't think so. I don't think, to be honest, that she did. Mm. I don't think it ever occurred to her that the place I should be with was with maladjusted children.
It was just accidentally worked
out. I think so, yes. I think it was because Lila Rendell was her cousin and would take me in, and I only went as a pantry maid. But it's a rather strange community.
Mm. What about the family generally? I mean, I have the impression that she, well, there's no doubt that she valued the Rendell connection to medicine. She liked family life, didn't she? I mean, family in the big sense.
Yes, she did.
She liked Christmas gatherings and things like that, did she?
No, she didn't like Christmas gatherings. She didn't like Christmas at all, because she thought there were a lot of people buying things that they shouldn't be buying, and giving presents that people didn't need, and eating more than they needed, and drinking more than they needed.
I always hear her saying this.
And she really preferred to be somewhere else. She used to say, peace, perfect peace, with loved ones far away. And sometimes she went down to West Bay, and then I felt it was my duty to go down to West Bay, and I spent a couple of very miserable cold Christmases alone with her, and not very much food, because though I was doing the cooking, she was always saying, well, I shouldn't bother to buy that, let's just have an egg or something. And it's terribly uphill work when someone is permanently saying, don't let's bother, or don't let's have anything. And it was always cold and nasty, and I think I only did it about two or three times, and I struck.
What was she doing then? Reading books? Was she
or? Reading books and walking about, not very great distances, but walking about. No, I was bored stiff.
She was quite a religious woman, really, wasn't she? In a rather unorthodox way.
A very unorthodox way. I used to think she was a religious woman, and she certainly knew her religious literature, though she didn't at all know the heresies or any of the sort of background. She knew the Bible. I don't think she was anywhere on other forms
theology
of theology. And yet, when she became sickly towards the end, her religion appeared to have absolutely disappeared. It gave her no support. There was nobody that she could talk to. It was presumably an academic, pleasurable subject.
A cultural thing.
Cultural thing. Beautiful literature like Trollope. I don't understand it at all. I used to think she was religious. But certainly, when we were children, she had a class on Sunday, so that she never went to church. And as I remember it, we didn't have to go to the church at the end because it was whitewashed pink and nobody could go to church whitewashed pink. At any rate, we had to walk up the road to meet her on Sunday. And when I was small, we only walked a quarter of the way to meet her. And when I was big, we even managed sometimes to get the whole way to her class up this straight road.
Did she actually read the Bible very much? I mean, do you remember her reading
it? Yes, she read it a lot. And, of course, Westfield was in a period when she could read it every day in chapel. And she drove that chapel and made it so there was enormous attendance to chapel. She made it so interesting and so exciting with what she read or what she produced or how she married the music to the literature.
She planned the whole thing.
Planned the whole thing and took the service. Mm. And never had a clergyman near it if she could avoid it. And it was a humming concern. Mm. Pleasure for people to go to. The Bible is literature. And it's exactly the same way as her cousin Lila Rendell used to run the Caldecott Chapel with readings from anywhere, whether it was Macefield or Bible, whatever it was. A whole service that anybody could go to.
What about, I mean, the thing you must have thought about quite a lot, at least at first, is advertising. I mean, she was against the sort of consume side of advertising, I suppose, wasn't
yes.
she? So it defends her Puritanism, really, doesn't it? What else was there behind that? Was that all there was?
I think it was only persuading people to buy things they didn't really need.
Mm.
That it was immoral to do that.
Mm.
This was a form of temptation.
Because she didn't, I think she says somewhere, or somebody's told me about her, that she found property an encumbrance, really, a nuisance.
Oh, yes.
And you felt that about her, did you? That she didn't really want to accumulate things around her.
No, she didn't want to accumulate. I've always agreed with her on this, in fact. And she said, yes, you can have anything. I'll lend you anything, I'll give you anything except my toothbrush. And I've always rather thought that. If there's a better home for a thing, if somebody wants a thing badly, I'm delighted they should have it.
Yes, it's a nice attitude, that.
But we used to worry because somebody would come and say, I was thinking of buying a nest of tables. It's all very nice nest of tables. I must see if I can get one. I want one to... She said, well, take it.
In a sense, that's a great virtue if you love your nest of tables, but I suppose in a sense you're not very keen on your brown.
Well, yes, and also when we think that we shall probably be running her next party or that when we do her Sunday lunch on Sunday, there'll be nothing to put the drinks on. And, of course, the other awkwardness was various jumble sales or fairs that she felt she had to go to. She would take her property out of her flat and give it them, you see. And then we'd have to replace it.
Can we get back to health a bit? Because she did worry you a lot, didn't she, towards the end of her life, because she had these pills, didn't she? She didn't sleep at all well.
She didn't sleep well, but she had always thought it was immoral, really, to take sleeping pills, and that you would become addicted to them. And I don't think she really started taking any pills of any sort until she was about 70, possibly 75. And then she wasn't sleeping, but of course she wasn't getting much exercise. I think it's possibly a vicious circle.
Yes, I mean, old people don't sleep as much as young people anyway, do they?
But way back in the 1930s, my father, who had been badly injured in the First World War, was sent to the West Indies, or sent away a term off, and a cousin of my mother's, naturally, said, come to the West Indies with me, and he went on a banana boat. I suppose he had 6 months off. And my mother lodged us in various places because she'd been rather run down, and went off and joined him for a term. And for some reason, a doctor had put her on insulin to build her up and make her fatter. And the moment she found that it was, in fact, making her slightly fatter, she gave it up. She thought this was not necessary. She was all right.
In fact, she regarded doctors as professionals in a way, didn't she, who she deferred to, rather. I mean, she wasn't anti-doctor at all, was she?
Oh, not at all. Her father was a doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, yes.
No, she believed in them. But she believed in them as family doctors, I think. No, she always believed in her doctors. She used occasionally towards the end to say she wished she was the queen. Then all her little aches and pains could be attended to immediately.
She presumably regarded her body as a sort of machine that needed to be kept in running order.
I think so, really. Yes.
So you just get someone to put this far right,
yes.
Whatever it may be.
Yes. But she did keep, she was always very well. She did have this one illness when, about the same time as my father did.
But in general, health wasn't a thing that was uppermost in discussion.
No, not at all. Not at all. No, it was rather sort of airy one. It was wicked to be ill.
Yes. All that fits together, isn't it, with everything else. Yes. I don't know, I don't want to sort of dwell on her last period, because it might be painful to you, but I wondered quite, you know, how she sort of felt about her last year. Did she know she was going to die, in fact, do you think?
She was lying to die. I think that was the thing that worried my sister. She was a member of the Euthanasia Society. She was very anxious to put herself away. And I think she kept thinking that it would be inconvenient. And I could see her point. She couldn't really think of a way of doing it which wasn't a nuisance for somebody somewhere. And she had found she didn't want to do it, you see, with her own doctor's pills, because it would get her own doctor into trouble. But she was very hurt when Beryl Power managed to do it very neatly, exactly when she said she was going to do it. And I think that piqued her rather. But she had got a pal in the House of Lords who'd given her some knockout pills. And this annoyed my sister very much. And I think it gave her a sort of like an alcoholic having a bottle put away somewhere. I think it gave her a sort of safe feeling. No, she was longing to die.
Just because she was lonely, or because her friends had died?
I think, what do you think? Partly because all her friends had died, but mainly that she couldn't do any of the things she wanted to do. She couldn't read for as long as she wanted to. She didn't sleep well. Her hand was shaky, so she couldn't write as well as she wanted to. She had to dictate things or have a secretary. Everything she wanted to do, she couldn't walk properly. She had to rely on other people. That hurt her very much.
Because that is the sort of point where one would have thought some sort of religious faith would, as you say, become come useful to you, but
it never appeared at all. I'd love to know why or what happened to her. Never at all. Of course, my sister is exactly the same. She can't bear to rely on other people or to be indebted. I don't think my mother minded being indebted, but she didn't wish to rely on other people. She wished to do everything herself.
Did your mother like the company of young people on the whole, do you think? I mean, in her later life, that is when she was a grandparent.
I think they interested her, but mostly I think they irritated her. I think things went too quickly. She never had long enough talk with any of them. I mean, she never had Kate to herself for half a day. She only had her in the middle of Sunday lunch sort of thing. And the same with my nephew Mark, who she would have got on very well with. I don't think they ever had long talks. But I don't know whose fault it was. I mean, she could have done if she'd wanted to.
Because there's that marvellous incident which both your sister and Kate told me about, where she was inquisitive for some reason about drugs.
Oh, yes.
And so she got Kate to get her some cannabis or something and smoked it. Was that untypical, really? That sort of terrific inquisitiveness.
I don't think it was. I think that she met every new invention and intended to absorb it and use it. And she did it with radio, and she did it with television. Though her vanity came out in television. She didn't like television because she never looked well on television. And of course in the early days they painted her face yellow. And the other thing she was allergic to, she couldn't stand makeup. She couldn't see any reason for anyone to put any makeup on their faces.
Yeah.
Radio came, she did it. Television came, she did it. Driving, of course.
She drove, did she?
Yes, when my father first got a car in Oxford, a lovely little Austin 7, he was given 4 free lessons, and when he got them, he taught her.
So she drove
around. So she drove, from 1914, I suppose. Probably 1916, because the car died of over childbearing, and they didn't have that number of children by then. It was a nice thing.
She was a very patriotic woman, wasn't she? I mean, she liked the monarchy, she liked...
I don't think she liked abroad much. Her German was good, and she... been to Germany with my father, and she, because one of his best friends was German, and we were always having that wretched family over. Her German was very good, I think. She spent some time in Germany, and also, I suppose, from the winter sporting as a child. Her French was adequate. But she, I don't think she really liked abroad all that much.
And in the war, she responded, presumably, she had only 5 inches of bath water and things like that.
Oh, absolutely. No, she did have a barrel of beer in her bathroom. <It's nice. laughs> Oh, yes. But then she would never have had more than 5 inches of water, I don't think.
Not any.
Wouldn't have bothered. No.
No,
I don't think so. No.
But, of course, the whole business of running Westfield in the war must have taken quite a lot of doing, running a community like that in a wartime context.
Yes, and you see, I think she was much more liberal than... she was much kinder to the young people and thought they should live adult lives much more than her predecessors, or indeed, I think, her successors, or most principals.
Mm. Mm.
And when they came and said, is there any rule saying I can't keep bees in my room? She didn't immediately say, well, of course you can't keep bees. She said, well, no, I don't think there is any rule. We look it up, but I feel sure there isn't any rule. I should do it. Have a go. I think she would always encourage them to use every bit that they could of the university and spread.
She became very anti-universities towards the end of her life.
Oh, she was anti the squandering of the money of the universities, but then she had, in a way, the right, having sat on the university grants and seen how the money was given out.
Mm.
And also she was anti, when she was principal, the sort of Parkinson's law that everybody would try to make their department bigger, naturally, and the moment one got an assistant, every other department thought, well, if the mathematics department's got an assistant, then I should have an assistant.
Mm. Mm.
And not on the work, but on their own aggrandizement.
Mm. On careers, then, I mean, both your parents and certainly she deliberately refrained from pushing any of you, did they? I mean, in their own mind, anyway.
I think in their own mind.
Mm.
I don't ever remember careers being discussed at all, actually.
Mm.
But I dare say they discussed it with Sister Anne. And it was never necessary with my brother, because from the age of 4 he knew he wanted to be an engineer, and it was just up to him to take himself the sort of direction he wanted to go.
Mm.
People are very lucky when they know exactly what they want to do.
Yes.
He knew absolutely exactly, never any trouble.
But did you, the two girls, did you both feel that you had to have careers as women?
Oh, yes.
Her feminism did exist.
I don't know about Sister Anne, but I couldn't see any way out of it.
Mm.
I thought it would be nice to sit back and be a wife and have it kept by a nice man and have 12 glorious children.
Mm. But she felt, and it looked to you both, to have careers where you could be self-supporting.
It was never said.
It was just in the air, sort of, in the atmosphere, in a way.
It just never said. It just... because, indeed, when I was at this terrible boarding school, it never occurred to me that I'd have a career, because I was deeply in love with a young man, and I was determined that the moment I was 18 I was going to marry him.
Mm-hmm.
So I never had any intention of having a career.
Did she,
it was never discussed.
Did she get on with you all equally well and treat you as equals and the three children?
Well, my brother and I used to think that she favoured my sister. And it is true, of course, that they were more alike. Their subjects were alike.
Candy, in a way.
And that they could talk to each other.
Mm.
And my brother and I could only giggle together. And, but my sister, I was known as the apple, and it always surprised me, because it never seemed to me I was the apple of her eye.
So
because we had nothing in common, and we had no conversation in common, really.
Mm.
The only thing we had in common was backgammon, and we used to go to the cinema on Saturdays.
But in fact, your sister thought that she favoured you, so on the whole then it looks as though she really dealt out.
It must have been played fairly equally. But we certainly always thought that she favoured Anne. I suppose really that we would like to have been the sort of person that we thought she would like us to have been. And in fact, she was quite content that we were what we were.
How do you fit that last thing where she was publicised in the paper saying something like the word of the effect that Wedgwood Bend scares the life out of me, or whatever the phrase was? Why did she come out with that? Because it seemed in a sense rather out of character in a way.
It might have been partly that she had known his father and had loved his father, and that he was a very gentle person, and that Wedgie Benn is a very aggressive, intelligent, powerful man. I think he is quite frightening. I think he is very able and powerful.
Very able, I think he is.
And he has a ruthless streak, which she, I think, thought was malicious and dangerous.
Because she'd always been rather on the left of the Labour Party in a way, hadn't she? I mean, for instance, on Ireland.
Well, she never managed, I don't think she was ever a member of the Labour Party.
She's not in any sense a sort of centre-left, I would have thought, in her political views, is she?
I would have thought she was. Well, as the Labour Party changed...
She stayed in the same place, you mean?
Yes, and they would follow... She never would have followed them to comprehensive schools. And all this nationalisation. I think she was really just a plain socialist. She wanted the happiness of a lot of people. But in fact, she didn't want that. It irked her that the bulk of the people now had cars and could get about and go on foreign holidays. She couldn't quite accept that the people were happier and that this was their right, the things that she has always had, that they now had.
But she didn't, I suppose it would be impossible to be of her generation upbringing not to notice class distinction. She noticed, presumably.
Oh yes, I think she knew there was such a thing. But she didn't, as it were, tolerate it.
No.
It used to amuse her, in fact, that... I don't know whether... She had a neighbour called Lady Norman, who was the widow of Montague Norman, who had a butler called James and a housekeeper called Lillian. And James could never be anything except a butler. And Lillian could come to lunch and talk on equal terms. But James couldn't have borne to have sat down at table with Jan.
And that amused her.
And that amused her and it fascinated her, because the things never could really sort out what was really the difference, why there was any difference between these two. They were both people who spoiled Lady Norman. We didn't really need to have all these people looking after her. And James was perfectly happy as he was and wouldn't have liked to have sat down to tea.
Your mother had, I don't know who she was, but she had someone up from the country, from Dorset or something, who used to stay with her now and again, didn't she?
Well, she had this little nurse, Latterly, who used to come up. But again, they couldn't stand each other for too long. Elsie, was only about this high, used to come up from Somerset when we sent for her for about a month. But Elsie wasn't that happy with the outside Somerset, and my mother couldn't really stand the sort of spoiling and the milk puddings and the waiting on for too long. And yet when Elsie wasn't there, she would say, I wish I was the Queen, there'd be somebody to carry in my meals and do this, that and the other.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't really like being waited on.
Mm-hmm. But Elsie was a person, what, a former servant?
No, she wasn't. She was a district nurse who used to look after the widow of somebody that my mother used to know. She'd only known Elsie for perhaps the last 10 years of her life.
Mm-hmm.
Elsie had said before this person died, you know, if you ever want a nurse, you let me know. And so we had the temerity to ask Elsie. And my mother used to go down and stay with Elsie, a sort of compulsory holiday, so we could go away and not fret about her. And she'd go down for a fortnight, but she never stayed more than about 10 days.
Mm. She didn't really like holidays, or didn't like being out of London?
Well, she didn't like holidays, she didn't like being out of London, she didn't like... She always said she liked being there. She talked a lot about the people there, which was a very classy society. I mean, you know, working class society. I think she just couldn't, also the sort of spoiling of her, she didn't really like in a strange sort of way.
Well, it's
also she liked her own flat, like any old person, she didn't really want to get back to their own bed.
Yes, and a liking for privacy. And
yes, I think liking for privacy.
Mm.
And adult conversation.
Mm.
Which
conversation obviously did matter to her, didn't it? I mean, the BBC.
Yes.
Thing is, it's just the top dressing of a lot of conversations.
Yes.
That went
all the time. Conversation. I think conversation wouldn't have mattered quite so much if her eyes had been just that much better, so she could have read more easily.
Mm.
And also, I suspect he was physically uncomfortable sitting in a chair too long. I mean, people, one is.
Mm.
And she had no other pursuits.
Mm.
She couldn't or wouldn't cook.
Mm.
She couldn't or wouldn't iron or clean the house.
There was
nothing else that she could do.
Mm.
She couldn't draw because her hands shook.
It upset her a great deal when the BBC sort of signed her off, didn't it?
Yes. Yes, it did.
And there's just no way of doing that without people knowing, is there? I mean,
well, also, she did any questions for about 20 years. And even towards the end, they never gave her the ones in London or near London. They went on giving her the most distant ones.
Mm-hmm.
And all the time... For years and years, she'd say, for heaven's sake, don't give me Good Friday. Always seem to give me Good Friday and the bank holidays, and it's such dreary places and such terrible. And they never stopped doing it.
Mm.
So you think they didn't handle her very sensitively?
Well, I don't think they did. I mean, when you think, they were very careful with people like Ralph Whiteman, and they would go to his house. And she could have done the same things, conversations from her house, the sort of things they did with Streeter and his gardening, which was never more than 4 or 5 minutes.
Mm.
Maybe, you know, they did. She may have said to the BBC, look, of course I can walk along Oxford Street or whatever it is.
Well, it's true. And also, latterly, she didn't realise how scatty she was getting. And
you mean on the radio more?
She wasn't collecting her thoughts.
Mm.
Not so much on the radio, but yes, towards the end on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I remember her vividly saying, somebody was talking about housekeeping or something, and she shocked everybody on any questions. I said, of course, I never make my bed. There's
yes,
no need to make a bed every day. Was that typical in her attitude in housekeeping? I mean, presumably only when she didn't have servants she wouldn't do these things, as obviously the servants would have done them. Well, I went to see her twice. I caught a glimpse of her bed as I saw it, and it was made.
No, I think what she meant really was that she didn't make it fundamentally.
Mm.
That if you slept quietly, it didn't get much disarranged.
I see.
You just pulled it up.
Yes, I see. I mean, she wasn't a housekeeper in the sense of worrying about.
No, she just pulled it up tidily.
Mm.
And she used to say, as you make your bed, so you sleep on it.
Mm.
And if you straighten it and you don't mind it being slightly ruffled at the bottom,
mm.
why make your bed? I know, I don't make my bed either.
Mm.
But it was always tidy. It wasn't like my nephew's bed. Never pulled up at all. No particular reason. And I remember her coming to stay with me when I was down at this Caldicott community. And every day after breakfast, there was time for housework. And she would go around and say, it seems to be perfectly clean. Because she couldn't see, she didn't see dust under beds.
Mm.
It was not important. But when, but she would see a stalk in a sink.
Mm.
There are certain things she would see, but never dust under a bed or anything like that.
Mm.
Just didn't see it at all.
She had a very good sense of humour. It was a sort of dry sense of humour, really. Wasn't it sort of ironic in a way, wasn't it, her sense of humour, really? It wasn't roisterous or boisterous, was it at all?
No, I don't think it was. But it was ironic, but I don't think it was unkind.
No.
I don't think I ever remember her destroying anyone.
No.
I once saw my father destroy someone, but he had been a bit uppish.
I mean, she was very austerely amusing somehow, as I remember her anyway. But I don't know what she was like in family company when she was completely relaxed. I mean, would she be the soul, life and soul of the party and sort of.
Oh yes, because she could tell a story so beautifully. A simple thing like somebody coming down some stairs, she could make sound so amusing.
Mm.
And you think it was the most important event of the day.
So would she hold forth in the family circle rather? I mean, and sort of entertain you all?
Yes, in fact, she really required to. Apart from the fact that she found it difficult to hear when a lot of things were going on, she really did prefer to be the centre. She didn't like other things to be going on.
Mm.
She really didn't like two conversations going on at the same time, and although she said it was because she couldn't hear, she really did like to be the centre. And usually she was, because she was amusing about anything.
Oh, yeah, I believe that. It was some time before you could get her to watch television, wasn't it? I mean,
she never looked at television much.
Mm.
When I used to go over at weekends, and occasionally, if it was, she would stay reading in her room, sitting room, while I was in the dining room in the cold, watching television. And occasionally, somebody, one of her friends was coming on, I'd say, oh, Vic Feather's on. She'd say, oh, tell me when it's starting. And she'd be late getting there. Probably miss it. But she came with no great pleasure, just as soon not bother.
What about the writing of her books? Did she shut herself off in a very obvious way when she was writing? She wrote quite a lot of books, really, didn't she?
She didn't. I suppose I wouldn't have noticed some of them.
Helen Rathbone was about 1948.
She used to go up to Manchester for the Ernest Simon one, and the library gave her a carol to work in. But then she was likely to be away every now and again. It wasn't abnormal.
Mm.
It wasn't all that often. She was often staying with the Simons. Rathbone one was mostly in London.
District nursing.
It wasn't noticed. Neither of my parents made much comment about writing and reviewing books or anything else. My father would write while my mother and I were playing backgammon on the floor. Nothing distracted him. He used to say sometimes that the rattle of the dice distracted him, but almost no other noise distracted him.
Mm.
They both wrote furiously and paid no attention to anything else. And in the war, I had to take a whole lot of children to a household in Oxfordshire where there was a fairly eminent man who made us all be absolutely silent for 2 days while he was doing a review of a book. And I thought this was so ridiculous when I'd been brought up with parents who would review books
just
like that.
Your mother was a very good reviewer, actually, I think. I've read a lot of her reviews. And they're very good reviews, I think.
Well, I don't know whether they were good, but I do know, which I approved of, that she wouldn't review a book if she didn't like it.
Mm.
She would give it to someone else to review.
Mm.
And I remember this happening when Tolkien first came, and somebody sent her Tolkien. And she thought, this is not me. And she sent it to my uncle, who adored it, and wrote a sparkling review of it. Which is sensible. I mean, if it's the sort of thing you can't stand.
Well, the function of a review is to bring out what's nice about it, isn't it? And there's no point otherwise, really.
And it certainly is no good saying that this man's writing about something I particularly dislike. Nobody in their senses could possibly like it. It's what's wrong with, of course, some theatre critics.
Oh, yes. Or else they just use the review as an excuse to show off. But was she businesslike in the sense of, I suppose, in a sense you're implying, aren't you, that money, she wasn't really good at managing money?
Oh, well, she was meticulous, yes. I would think that every cheque that came in was carefully documented, every cheque that went out. Her accounts for the tax returns, I would think, were absolutely immaculate.
Mm.
Of course, she never kept any spare piece of paper, you see. And everything was always in the right place, in the right order. And if something went wrong with the electric mixer, and I said, well, haven't you got the bill for it? Or she'd say, well, it must be third drawer down. It must be in that pile of, I've got all the bills for the last year or last 2 years.
So she was well organised on the trivial details of life in a way.
Absolutely, immaculately.
Mm.
And, I mean, I used to say, well, it'll be no trouble when you die because you will have not only got all the things organised, but you'll die in your coffin already. There'll be nothing for us to do.
She was anxious not to be troublesome.
Oh, always.
That's not just at the end of her life.
No, always.
It's part of this independence thing, I suppose, is it? And it's a nice thing in a way.
It may have come, or her mother was the same, is really what I should say. Her mother always used to say, I will not be an incubus. I will not be a kept woman. I will not be an incubus.
We've talked about a lot about how you've given a really marvellously rounded sort of picture of your mother. Is there anything you think we ought to have talked about that we haven't? I mean, I may well not have asked you the question that would really bring her out alive. I don't know.
I don't think so. I think we've covered most of the facets. Uh, she didn't know about London. It was fantastic. I've got some of her London books, but she had a wonderful collection of old maps and old histories of London.
Did she really?
She really loved it.
She has quite a lot about conservation, or about the awfulness of London when it's invaded by tourists in her book, doesn't she?
Yes.
She feels it should be a place that's lived in by people who reside there permanently, and not just as a...
But she read a lot, I think, on old London and the Great Wen and...
Because she'd been brought up as a girl in London. She'd been to the London School of Economics.
Been at St Paul's School.
Yes, yes.
She'd done her care committee work.
Yes.
And her... suffragette work.
And she'd done her courtship from London. She'd gone up to Oxford.
She'd gone up to Oxford, yes. And then... she'd waited in London while my father was at the war and had two of her children in London.
Did she keep a diary about that?
I forgot to ask her.
No. Again, my wife thought that she'd be sort of counting for time. You know.
No, she had an engagement book.
Yes, oh, sure.
Ordinary engagement book. Mm. And all her letters, letters for... saying, will you come and speak, or will you do this, or the notes for the next meeting, always with the date on the top, so that she just peeled it off and got down to the next minutes of the next agenda, or whatever it was, when the next meeting was, whatever it was.
One of the things that interests me about these women, I mean, your mother's not unusual, is that they are very good politically. That is, they know how to get things done. They know how to organise the British political system or whatever. This is in the 20s and 30s. Did you feel your mother had a sort of sense in that way?
Oh, yes. This was really why it fitted so naturally, that she could never have belonged to the militant suffragettes, because she was always... that there was a correct channel, and you should go through the correct channels. And this is why all these societies and things, when they took her on, they took her on for her to do the lobbying, because she knew the way the thing should be done at the top, not the committee work or the convening of meetings or the sitting on the committees, but she knew the paths.
Yes.
I think what one does forget, and that is what we haven't talked at all, is her enormous love of the theatre.
Oh yes, that's something I hadn't quite realised actually.
Her adoration of Ellen Terry, and all her life she had a picture of Ellen Terry on her mantelpiece.
Did she really?
That on her honeymoon she went the flat, I've forgotten the name of the woman now, after the theatre, and waited in the flat and had a sort of party again after the theatre. She always, at the University Settlement, you see, she was writing plays for University Settlement, and my father was taking part of them in them, or she was producing plays.
Of course, it's amateur dramatics, that was quite important, wasn't it?
She was... in the organisation of the Russian Repertory Theatre at Manchester, and tried to see it through its terrible financial pitfalls. She really had quite a lot of friends. She chose actors and actresses for the Repertory Theatre. She sat on committees. And then, of course, latterly, she was on the governing body of the Central School of Speech and Drama, which gave her immense pleasure. She went a lot to the theatre, quite a lot, and took very, very great pleasure. She read plays, always.
How does that feel? Because one wouldn't think that she herself would be a very good actress, amateur actress.
But she wasn't. I think she... only time I remember her appearing she got the words wrong, but her usual skill got it right. She was doing, saying Blake's Jerusalem, and she said, "Bring me my bow of burning steel," and didn't know she'd said it, but at the end said, "Oh, clouds unseal." And somebody said, "That was quick-witted," and she said, "What was quick-witted?" She had no idea she'd done it. But that's the only part I can ever remember her doing, but she was always producing or helping in some way with the theatre.
She,
of course, was my father.
She was, in a way, a performer, wasn't she? She enjoyed doing her performances on Any Questions. I mean, she'd
yes.
do a turn, in a sense, wouldn't she, I suppose, in that way. She'd
yes.
live up to expectations, if you know what I mean.
And there were one or two turns she would do in the family. She had an idiot face that she used to put on to make us laugh sometimes. But I don't know. I don't think she liked to be ridiculous. I think there was a grain of vanity there, and I think this is why our television didn't suit her again. That her voice and her intelligence in reading, and reading aloud, and speaking, was really her métier. And she was a sound woman. She listened to the radio
yes.
enormously.
Yes, even
every radio play. And
yes, because she's very much that generation. I mean, the radio starts becoming important around 1926. Well, she started
a young
housewife. What about her autobiography? Did you all press her to write it, or did she just write it unexpectedly to you, or what?
Oh, she started it unexpectedly, and we kept telling her it was all wrong. That was quite easy. No trouble about that.
You mean she showed you drafts or something?
No, she used to read us a chapter.
Mm. And you'd say, "Well, that detail's wrong, or this detail's wrong."
No, we'd say, "That's delightful, but let's have more about so-and-so."
I see.
But she was always cutting it down, cutting it down.
Was the publisher made her cut it down even more?
Yes, he did. Very, very ill-advised. Because it was so full of anecdotes, and she wrote anecdotes such as nobody writes. The stories that she used to tell of her childhood or things that had gone on were fascinating. And it would have been much, much more interesting to have a first book of, say, the first 20 years and a second book of the next lot, instead of one book which went from 0 to 70 and another book which went from 30 to 70 on a different theme.
But you don't know what started her writing. She hadn't said that she was going to write her autobiography to you.
I think on occasions we had said, "Well, why don't you write your own? I mean, you've done all these other people, and the district nurse isn't." Things like that.
Because I think it's very good, actually. I mean, for instance, the thing that I do refer students to on the women's suffrage movement is her chapter in her autobiography, which is the best thing there is, and the most balanced account of the whole women's suffrage business. Is, which is rather surprising considering she was involved in it, that she's able to do that. But of course this is all rather impersonal, and in a sense one does feel with her autobiography that she's not very self-revealing, really. Talks about other people and movements and formal public things, but she's not.
There's not an awful lot about her in it,
in
a funny sort of way. And it's a pity, because there are some lovely stories that should have been in.
Which is one reason, really, I had the feeling a bit with your sister that she felt her mother had told her story and that's all there really was. And that if she thought anything else was important, she would have written it down. In a way, I don't think... I may be putting words into your of mouth, but I mean, I myself feel that there is probably quite a lot that she didn't write down, because she doesn't believe in self-indulgence, and writing about yourself is self-indulgent in some
ways. Yes, I think this is true.
So she'd no more write about herself than she...
It would have been much better if somebody had, as it were, interviewed her for her biography, and let them do the selecting. But
I rather agree with that. Well, let us do the washing up.